Tonight on Arena, Niamh O'Sullivan and Sophie Motley on the I&O opera Werther, and Renfield, One Fine Morning and Barber are our films for review. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. Let's kick off with film reviews this evening. And first up is Renfield, who lovers of Bram Stoker's Dracula will know is the Count's devoted disciple with a penchant for eating flies. Renfield stars Nicholas Holt in the title role, who centuries on finds himself in a toxic relationship with his blood-sucking boss, played by Nicolas Cage. Our second film is Barber, an Irish mystery thriller centering on the efforts of a woman to find her missing granddaughter. To this end, she engages Val Barber, a private detective who is drawn into a murky world involving dodgy businessmen and a slimy politician. The film is directed by Fintan Connolly, who we interviewed earlier this week, along with the co-star Helen Behan. And finally, One Fine Morning is a French domestic drama written and directed by Mia Hansen-Love. It stars the acclaimed actress Léa Seydoux in the film that won the Europa Cinema's Label Award for Best European Film at the Cannes Film Festival. Chris Wasser and Jim McRae have been to see all three. Now we will start with Renfield, a comedy about Dracula's put-upon assistant, the Renfield of the title. It's the latest cinematic effort at injecting comedy into the Dracula story. This one is set in New Orleans and starring Nicolas Cage as the man with the fangs. So how up to date is it, Chris? And give us a sense of the story.
Yeah, well, the story takes place in present-day New Orleans. For reasons that will be explained in the opening minutes, basically Dracula gets caught in the sun at some stage throughout, you know, his time with Renfield, and Renfield is nursing him back to health. But anyway, we're in present day, and Renfield has kind of taken it upon himself to go out and find, you know, snacks, people, you know, for his master to feed on. And the way he does that, of course, is by attending these support groups for people in abusive relationships. So he's sitting there listening to these poor people talk about the people who are abusing them in their relationships or in, you know, at work, at home. And then he goes out and finds those, you know, monsters. They are monsters to the other people, and brings them back to Dracula. But the longer that he's in these meetings, he realizes one day, I'm in a toxic relationship and I need to sort this out. And that's the basic setup. But then the film kind of slips into this other kind of genre where, you know, we're dealing with an angry traffic cop who is mixed up in the mob. They had something to do with the death of her father, and also this kind of, you know, cartoonish gangster who's trying to prove things to his mother. Renfield and Dracula end up in the middle of all that, and if it sounds complicated, that's because it is.
Okay, well, let's go back to the self-help group, because I was following you very clearly
until then.
And Renfield, played by Nicholas Holt, attends a self-help group to help with his dependency and obviously find some meat for his master. He explains his situation to the group, which is led by Mark, played by Brandon Scott Jones.
Renfield, this is codependency 101. A narcissist will take full advantage of a codependent's low self-esteem, but you're the one with the real power. And all you gotta do is take it back.
How do I do that?
Focus on your needs.
I mean, I just haven't thought about any of my needs in years.
But if you were to stop focusing on his needs, what would happen?
If I don't...
Yeah, what would happen? Stop focusing on his needs, what would happen?
He won't grow to full power.
Exactly. He won't grow to full power. What? That's so weird. Why would you phrase it like that? But yes, he's right.
Won't grow to full power. So, Jim, there's this toxic relationship between master and servant, Renfield being Dracula's servant. So the chemistry, I guess, between Dracula, played by Nicolas Cage, and Renfield, played by Nicholas Holt, must be pretty key to the success of the film.
So, our titular character Renfield has certainly come a long way, as the actor, from about a boy, and he is this kind of rather kind of good looking, but playing that very kind of belittled, put upon English guy with low self-esteem, you know, which sits very well in this cartoonish American broad world of excess of New Orleans. He's trying to do good, but within the constraints of Dracula's world, where he's serving him, he, you know, saves him. He's ultimately someone that Dracula relies on, but is deeply manipulated, and he feels so desperately guilty for all the people that he's killed over the years that he really only starts to believe that he can make up for all the damage that he's done when he meets Quincy, who's a police woman, who's a traffic cop in the New Orleans Police Department. She's been running the DUI beat, and she has been sort of stuck there when she really wants to go after the Lobos who had murdered her father.
And this is the character played by Awkwafina.
Awkwafina, yeah. So she is like this little ball of rage, but she's really brave and stands up to the Lobos in a way that really inspires Renfield to believe that he can change and he can kind of shirk off his master, the very vivacious Nicolas Cage in this, going like acting 110% and so enjoyable.
Okay, we'll come back to ask you about Nicolas Cage in a moment, but let's have a listen to Nicolas Cage. So Nicolas Cage as Dracula turns up at the self-help group again, which is being attended by Renfield. He's invited by Mark, this is Brandon Scott Jones's character, to introduce himself.
Would you like to introduce yourself to the group?
I'm the Prince of Alesia. Some call me the Dark One. Others, the Lord of Death. However, to most, I am known simply as
Redfield's boss.
Dracula.
Okay, obviously we're dealing with a little bit more than just narcissism here.
I'm loving this already. Nicolas Cage, you were a fan of Nicolas Cage.
Oh, yeah.
We've talked in detail about Nicolas Cage's career in the past, Chris. How does he fare as Dracula?
We have. I remember, Kay, we were talking about the fact that he at one stage came up with a term to describe his, you know, angular and often erratic style of acting, and that's nouveau shamanic. And he's, you know, had great difficulty trying to explain that to people because he made it up. It doesn't really mean anything. It's something about bridging the gap between shamans and thespians. Doesn't really make any sense, but he is always all in. And the moment you hear that Nicolas Cage is playing Dracula, you think to yourself, well, that makes sense, and I can't wait to see that. I think whatever film Nicolas Cage thinks he's making, I would like to see it, because he, as I say, is all in here. You know, there is a sense that, you know, he's
in his own movie, not in this movie.
Whatever film he thinks he's in, I would love to see it. You know, he's so excitable here, and he actually there are times where he's quite subtle as Dracula. But I loved him in this, you know, velvet red suit with the cape, with the top hat and cane when he walks into a room. Just the cartoonish kind of villain quality that he brings to it, that all worked for me. And so did the Renfield stuff. I thought Nicholas Hoult actually makes for a likable.
We've seen him in The Favourite, we've seen him in The Great. He's got great comic timing.
Fabulous, great comic timing, good with drama, very good in these kind of, you know, horror comedy setups as well. I just think the both of them deserved a bit of a better film, and Renfield does too, because there's an awful lot in there about, you know, how Renfield was basically just conducting a spot of business. He, you know, calls by Drac's Transylvania mansion. He's there as a real estate agent. He's got a wife and a child at home, and he has all of these dreams. And then they're all crushed because then he just becomes, you know, Dracula's servant, his familiar. He spends his time either hiding in the shadows, you know, nibbling on creepy crawlies, or basically going out and, you know, getting takeaways for his boss. And then when he starts to realize that, you know, there's more to life and that he could actually have his own life, that's another road we could go down. That's as interesting. But we actually see Renfield's turnaround in his life. It's actually all squeezed into this 60-second montage. And I thought, why, you know, Chris McKay, Ryan Ridley, all of the people behind this, why are you afraid to commit to the best idea in your film? Why are we constantly interrupted by, as I said at the start, this weird subplot that becomes the main plot, which involves the cop, which involves gangsters? It doesn't make any sense to me.
Now, Gemma, Nicolas Cage has played a vampire before in The Vampire's Kiss. And then there's the whole plethora of Dracula films, from Coppola's to Christopher Lee to Bela Lugosi. Where do you think Renfield fits into this pantheon?
It definitely, because it leans into the farcical, it sits in its own realm in that way. But I do think Nicolas Cage delivers real face-off energy. You know, that lovely kind of charming psychopath that, you know, that's completely over the top. Like if Vampire's Kiss, it spurred 1,000 memes that are still being used. Like it still
that's
speaks to someone.
One, yes.
Yeah. So it's that kind of exuberance really sells that, and it really sold this for me, because he is both completely off the wall and charming, but then you see the power he holds over Renfield, and it comes from a really manipulative, clever place. And that's what
I enjoyed. Was
there
enough of that for you? Because Chris seemed to think there wasn't enough of that.
Yeah, I thought there was a real darkness in the dynamic of the relationships. So if you look at Schwartz's character, Teddy Lobo, he is like a sycophant in training. He's someone who's desperately looking for the approval of his mother. He's someone who, you know, who doesn't really have what it takes to be a badass, but tries and tries to be as evil as possible to prove himself in this kind of very grim, very violent war of being a drug dealer. And I thought those elements, like, actually the characters just turn their heads on what you are expecting. So it's a love letter. It's cheesy. It fits into all the genre tropes, but I think every single one you're getting a little bit of something that's unexpected. And I think it plays true to the voice of Ryan Ridley, who's someone who wrote for Community, who wrote for Rick and Morty, and who can see a real kind of cutting darkness underneath those comedic elements as well, that I think really, really worked.
Okay,
this.
Well, I think you're going to slightly disagree on this. Stars out of 5 from you, Gemma.
Oh, I'm giving it M4, so it's a blood-soaked adventure.
4 out of 5 for Renfield from Gemma, and from you, Chris.
Great ideas, great cast, but I just thought it was a bit of a mess. Choppily edited too. Every time it kind of ran out of jokes, it just resorted to repetitive, gory cartoon violence, and that wasn't what I came for. So 2 out of 5. I will say, Kay, I would like to see Nicolas Cage do Dracula again in a better film.
Okay, come back and do it again.
Yeah.
Our next film is Barber, the title referring to a Dublin-based private detective called Val Barber, played by Aidan Gillen. This piece of Irish noir finds Barber searching for a missing young woman, leading him into contact with some shady character from the worlds of business and politics. Fintan Connolly directs. So bring us into the story of... Now, the character of Val Barber and his life is almost equally important to the story he's involved in. Could you just give us those two lines in the film?
Of course. So he's a private eye struggling to make ends meet when a wealthy widow comes into his dark office, and she is looking for her missing granddaughter. So her daughter had apparently was wrapped up in a bunch of strange underworld. Her stepfather is a person of interest. Her friends, there's like a seedy sex worker element, and he starts to use his Val Barber starts to use his ties to the force to really kind of get in there and start asking the tough questions. So Aidan Gillen does an amazing job as portraying this sort of isolated character who's personal life is as messy as this case turns out to be. He has an ex-wife with who he's trying to make amends with in order to deal with their daughter who's recovering from a brain injury. He has a complex set of relationships that he's really struggling to maintain with his friendships, with a few trysts that he has on the books. He's somebody that seems very lost when this film starts, and this case as well, but his daughter being of that age really kind of drags him into the murky underworld of corruption in the force and politics, much as noir does.
Let's listen to a clip from Barber. As you said, Aidan Gillen's character Val Barber was in the past a cop, so then he runs into Inspector Tony Quinn, played by Liam Kearney. Barber has just impersonated a police officer, obviously he's not one anymore, to gain access to the missing girl's house. So here he meets Inspector Quinn.
Would you look at what the cat dragged in. Valentine Barber, no less. We received a report of suspicious activity in the area.
Would have thought house calls were well below your rank, Inspector.
I know it was you snooping around O'Neill's house, so don't bother denying it. And as a former member, you should know that impersonating a member of An Garda Síochána is a very serious offence. especially if the said perpetrator was dismissed from the force.
I resigned.
Like you had any choice?
I have been hired by a member of the Dunn family to help find Sarah.
Your license?
Seriously?
Seriously.
No, social distancing, Inspector.
Stay out of my way if you know what's good for you.
I don't think Liam Kearney as Tony Quinn was going to care for social distancing. No. There's Aidan Gillen as Val Barber. So I said it's a film noir based in Dublin. That's very much what the director and the team are looking for. Did it work in on that level for you, Chris?
Not quite. I think a little bit, you know, similar to Renfield, although not very similar stories. There are some great ideas here, but I just think that the follow through requires work. And Gemma mentioned a lot of the ideas there about, you know, even there are enough ideas here when it comes to Barbara's private life to have just a drama where we actually don't get to see this detective, you know, go out and solve cases. There's so much going on in his private life. And then there's so much going on in this case, which seems a little, at the same time, simultaneously underpowered and a little overstuffed. And I'm not sure how they managed that.
The
mystery side of things, every time kind of, you know, like Barbara does a little bit of digging, it just seems to get a little bit more complicated and convoluted.
Yes, because they're building from Varsity's interaction is with the guards, then it's with a fixer, then it gets kind of into the world of politics.
Yeah, it's very simple to begin with. He has this mate, Johnny Mulligan, played by Gary Lydon, who I feel at this stage is contractually obliged perhaps to play a cop in everything that he does, but he is actually quite effective here.
Of course, he's a cop in the Banshees of
Inisherin. Everyone, I was rooting for all of the characters in here, and I was rooting for this story, I was rooting for this character, and I kept thinking to myself, this actually does feel like, you know, a sketch for a television series, and with a bit more breathing time and with heftier resources and with better timing too, it might have made for a very effective one. But it just feels as though the script isn't quite there, and it feels as though, and I realised too that, you know, it was shot on a low budget, and I realised that it was also made during COVID, as you heard in the clip there. But the pandemic element, as much as it's a part of the fabric and as much as I admire the fact that they got a film made in that time, it takes away from it. You start to, or at least I started to get a little bit, you know, irked by the masks, by the constant sanitizing, by that element of the story getting in the way. And I just kept thinking to myself, this may seem a little flippant, but the pandemic got in the way of real life so much, I don't want to see it getting in the way of what should be a promising crime fiction story.
That's a good point. I mean, it is in the film, but you kind of go, oh God, I'd really rather not see it there. But in the centre of all of this is Val Barber, the gumshoe, the Philip Marlowe-esque character. What kind of a character is he? And does Aidan Gillen do a good job? Do you feel you're in a noir?
Yeah, well, actually, for me, I don't necessarily agree with the noir label for this film. I think it has all the bells and whistles, the, you know, the PI element, the seedy underbelly of the Dublin city centre, the corruption, but it had too much heart. For me, the crux of this story was Aidan Gillen's rendition of Barber, who was a deeply troubled man who's refusing to acknowledge certain parts of his personality and who's struggling to connect with his wife and daughter and really wants to, but isn't able to do that. And I think that's, for me, why I thought the COVID stuff really worked, because it was this brilliant visual metaphor of his distance and his inability to connect and to engage and to properly communicate with other people. I think, again, I agree, I would have watched a show about the character of Barbara. I felt like his personal life was what shone for me, that the plot, the private investigation elements of it, like they were interesting. I think it spoke a lot to the post Me Too era. I thought even within that realm, what I really enjoyed as well is how rich the female characters were, and I think that's like a testament to co-writer Fiona Bergen. Not to say anything about Fintan Connolly, but I'm sure he was in there, but I could sense a strong female voice, and I did feel like that was reflected in the relationship and the time given to Barbara's interactions with his wife and daughter and how that fed back into the investigation. For me, I thought it was punching well above its weight with regards to a budget. So the house that he broke into, the location of that is extreme, and it was shot on a micro budget. So I'd like, if you're looking at something like this, it should be funded 10 times what it is, but it's punching so above its weight. We're kind of sitting here discussing the kind of ins and outs.
I don't think you're going to agree again.
Yeah.
So stars out of 5 from you, Gemma.
Oh, I think 3.5 stars, and it's more, that's a personal thing, that I'm not, that genre isn't necessarily for me, but actually it's the elements that deviated from the noir that really sold me on this.
And for Barbara, from you, Chris?
I admire the potential, the ambition, scope, ideas, cast. I just didn't enjoy the finished product, unfortunately. So 2 stars.
2 stars, mute. So 3.5 and 2 for Barbara. Our final film comes from one of the most acclaimed directors in modern French film, Mia Hansen-Love, and it stars an actor enjoying equal status on the other side of the camera. That's Léa Seydoux. The film centres on a young widow juggling her life as a daughter to an ailing father and a mother to a young daughter who she has raised alone. So this is a very domestic drama, Chris, but many layers, as there usually is in her films.
Oh, absolutely. So we have Léa Seydoux taking the lead as Sandra. And when we first meet her, she is going to check in on her father, Georges, played by Pascal Gregory, at his apartment in Paris. And we know straight away, because she needs to guide her father to the door to basically open up for her, that something's not right here. And he is in not even the early stages, but it's early on compared to how he is later on in the film. But he has a neurodegenerative disease known as Benson syndrome, which is a form of Alzheimer's. And it becomes clear to, you know, Sandra and later her siblings and also his ex-wife, who is quite caring still and still very much a part of his life, that he is going to need full-time care. But he is going to need, you know, a good home. And they all realize and they all talk about the fact that, you know, private homes are expensive and then the public homes come with 2-year-long waiting lists. So he'll have to be put in a hospital for it. So you think to yourself, this is a compelling family drama about, you know, what happens when the child becomes the parent and how stressful it can be, and even just like the small tasks like who gets what in father's apartment. But there's another side to it then, which is that, you know, Sandra is a widow and she has been raising her child by herself, Lynn, and she even says at one stage, you know, she never talks about the husband, but she does say that she considers the romantic side of her life to be over. And that is until one day an old friend, Clément is his name, he just appears, you know, out of nowhere. She hasn't seen him in so long, and he's been up in the North Pole working as something fascinating to do with the meteors. He comes back into her life, he's back in Paris, and you get the sense that there's always maybe been, you know, an attraction between them, and they actually follow through in that attraction. The only problem is he's married.
So he's married, Gemma, and she is, her life is, her own family's life is falling apart with the fact that she may have to put her father into care. And this is, I suppose, some wonderful break or escape for her.
Yeah, she's someone who's really pushed to her wit's end. So on one side, she's dealing with the sort of politics of her dad within the family as well. There's a lot of minefieldness to negotiate there. She has a really stressful job in which she speaks fluent German and she must translate there. And then, you know, she's someone who's kind of deeply lonely. She has no one to come home to talk to about all these pressures. So then when Clément comes on, and this is where I sort of disagree again, where he comes in, he hints that he's always really liked her. There's a little bit of flirting on her end, but like, bear in mind, she hasn't really had any adult company that isn't to do with stress or pain. And then he gives her this brief moment of reprieve. He's going, I've fallen, I have a distance with my wife. And, you know, he's playing that card, and I got the ick from him. There's a 15-year age difference between the two of them. She's sort of this vulnerable young woman who's alone, who is struggling through so much. And then he just kind of swoops in at that point. Like, I know it's played for the tension, but I actually think
It shows, I guess, how vulnerable she is, and that she is open to something like that because she's looking for an escape or something good in her life.
And he sort of initially love bombs her, and, you know, like, they have this very intense, very physical relationship that's played out on screen. And what's done interestingly is we're watching it sort of at a distance. It's very seen through mid shots. We don't get that much close ups, and you know the background of the city is always there. The audio is there, so it's not this kind of heightened, controlled version of the love story as well. It's more visceral. There's a lot of like slurping, which I know that sounds strange, but it's actually accurate. And it for me then, when I wasn't necessarily on board with their romance to get in with, I found it sort of awkward to watch those elements of it. And as it played out, you know, he'd pull away, move back to his wife, you know, then kind of like reach out again. And she was like an addict kind of craving his attention. I found it like to be a very toxic relationship as it played out on screen.
Did you think so, Chris? Could you understand why she was staying with him or craving him?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was almost as though, you know, what's going on with her father is so devastating. He kind of offered her, you know, this wild distraction that she could just, you know, even pretend to be happy. And they say that there was a mutual attraction there. I did get the feeling that there might have been something before, you know, years ago. But at the same time, you said, you know, he gave you the ick. Oh, absolutely. He's a total sleaze. You cannot root for a character who's cheating on his wife and is potentially walking out the family for it. No, you can't. You can't root for a character like that. And I don't think I was ever rooting for them, but I was rooting for Sandra just to find some form of happiness, because she just, you know, even work seemed to be kind of, you know, getting her down. But I liked the fact that one of the big things I liked about this film is that there's no grandstanding. There's no scene where something, you know, major happens and then everything just falls apart. It's so quiet and it's so authentic and it's so natural, but it grabs you in a way that other dramas don't. And I think a lot of that is down to Mia Hansen-Love's writing, but then also Lea Seydoux's performance. She is just extraordinary. She's the sort of actress who can kind of turn a scene inside out and upside down with just a look. And sometimes she does that. I mean, there's a lovely scene where she is, I think she kind of refuses to let everything that's happening in her life interfere with her work. But she sees a text come in one day when she's interpreting at an event. And you know straight away this is going to interfere with her work, and it does. And there's just this look that she has where you can tell that she's saying to herself, I'm never going to let that happen again. I'm feeling quite vulnerable here, but I'm not going to let that happen again. So I thought the cast were brilliant. And I also should say, I love the fact that, especially with Mia's films, that you feel as though you're just watching other people live their lives or carry out traditions. You have your own. I quite liked watching these people and their traditions and their celebrations, particularly at one stage, how they celebrate Christmas. I just sat there going, this is just a joy to just watch people do ordinary things sometimes. I know it sounds a little boring or dull, but it was anything but.
Yes, I remember in Bergman's Island, I love watching them, you know, cycle around the place and meet new people like you would on a holiday.
Oddly enchanting, yeah.
And like that as well, the pacing, that really worked for me as well. Like there's so many quiet moments where she's just, you follow her through her routine with her daughter, and you see her sort of processing the grief of her father, because, and you see every time she's with him how she loses a little bit of who he was, and she's reminded of that. And I think that's something this film does so beautifully is, you know, like not take those one big moments, but about how this relationship plays out over a long period of time and how it's imperfect and how that grief isn't that clear cut, you know, we're going through those five stages. It's just a messy, prolonged experience, which is so true to life and really well observed and gorgeous writing.
So stars out of five from you, Gemma, for One Fine Morning.
3.5 stars. It's really beautiful.
And from you, Chris?
Yeah, I thought at first it seemed a little soft around the edges, but it's actually, you know, it's probably the most profound thing in cinemas at the minute. So I'd say 4 stars.
Thank you very much, Chris and Gemma. The films are Renfield. The other one is Barber and One Fine Morning. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. Formed in the South Dublin Gaelscoil, Colaisha Owen, all the way back in 1987, Keela have gone on to become one of Ireland's greatest live bands, fusing traditional Irish music with a variety of other forms. The band's latest project continues with the experimental and groundbreaking determination as they bring an 8-piece brass band into the mix. Keela Le Pras. Keela with Brass is the self-evident title of the project, and the 8 pieces of brass featured in the new recordings come courtesy of the Paul Frost Brass Ensemble. Their latest signal, Clarilum, is taken from a forthcoming album featuring the newly partnered ensemble. So here we go. Get your dancing shoes on. It's Keela Le Pras with the song Clarilum.
Michael's calling on us, calling on me. Calling on, calling on, calling on my help. Michael's calling on us, calling on me.
That was a belter of a tune, wasn't it? Kila LaProsse, or Kila with Brass, the latest incarnation of Irish group Kila. Kila will be part of a lineup in a charity concert at Whelan's on Tuesday, April the 25th. Joining them on stage will be Sheila Denver, who featured on Arena earlier this week, also Na Bunny Men, Colm McInamara and others. And you can find full details about the concert at whelanslive.com. When psychologist Lydia Sandgren published her debut novel collected works in her native Sweden in 2020, it quickly became a best-selling sensation. It tells the story of Martin Berg, a failed writer and successful publisher whose life is thrown into turmoil when his beloved wife, Cecilia, vanishes. Meanwhile, their daughter, Raquel, thinks she has discovered an astonishing clue to her mother's sudden absence. And she's determined secretly to pursue it, whatever the emotional cost. Collected Works has been translated into English and it's published by Pushkin Press on the 6th of April. Here's Lydia Sandgren, and she reads an extract for us in which Martin seems to see his missing wife everywhere.
A din of voices rose towards the ceiling of the market hall. Coats were unbuttoned and scarves unwrapped, as customers leaned across counters to talk to clerks. Martin was waiting for his lamb chops to be cut when he caught a glimpse of a woman out of the corner of his eye. She was the right height, and her hair was cut in a curly bob, and for a second he felt like he was falling through the floor. Is that? No, Martin told himself. It never was. Look, now she's moving. And her face was a stranger's, as he'd known it would be. She had sharp eyes and determined creases between her nose and her mouth. She was holding a pair of gloves and carrying a handbag in the crook of her arm, and was probably about to go home to her family, where she would sit down with a glass of wine, feel annoyed at her husband cluttering in the kitchen, and ask her children about school without listening to their answers. She met his eyes and he looked away, as though he'd been just looking around and happened to linger on her for no reason. He quickly paid for his lamb chops and hurried outside. The sun was low in the sky. Martin stood in a ray of golden light with his eyes closed until his pulse slowed. He was going to walk home. That usually helped.
That was Lydia Sandgren reading from her novel Collected Works, published by Pushkin Press. The Irish National Opera is about to tour Ireland with Werther, Jules Massenet's masterpiece from 1892. Based on the novel by the German writer Goethe, Werther is the doomed love story between the young poet of the title and Charlotte, the wife of his best friend. Sophie Motley directs the production for Irish National Opera, while Italian tenor Parid Cataldo and Cork mezzo-soprano Nivo Sulfon play the star-crossed couple. Sophie Motley and Nivo Sulfon are with me now in studio. Sophie, what can you tell us about the original novel, The Sorrows of Werther? That became quite a sensation in Goethe's time, didn't it?
It did, absolutely. It was, it's possibly not as well known as Faust, but I think the huge thing about the novel is that it's a piece about a young man who falls in love with a young woman who isn't explored that much in the novel. But the exploration of this catastrophic love that he feels for her, which is utterly unrequited, bar one passionate kiss, sort of three quarters of the way through the novel, leads to his suicide. And the novel at the time caused a huge spike in young men taking their lives. They were so affected by the romantic hero of the novel that they took it upon themselves to live and end the way that he does. I think it was very early, sort of a Sturm und Drang novel, and it really, really affected the young men who read it.
And then Massenet made an opera from it. So he has changed it quite considerably and given Charlotte very much an equal part.
He has, absolutely. I think the novel is told from Verterra's point of view, and it's him writing letters to his friend about this love and a few sort of diary type entries, whereas Massenet realised the importance of the mezzo-soprano in opera and yes. and built in a number of female characters. And he wrote this fantastic part for Charlotte. So Charlotte is the wife, she becomes the wife of Albert, who's friends with Verterra. And Charlotte is a much larger part of the story in that she falls in love with him. She falls in love back and she goes through this huge crisis of what to do, whether to betray her husband, whether to betray the possibility of a marriage at the beginning of the opera, or whether to follow what duty asks, which is to be a good wife. So it's a really fantastic role.
And how juicy a role is it for you, Niamh?
Yeah, I mean, it's a role that I've always kind of dreamt of doing, didn't realise that I would do it, didn't think I would do it so early on in my career. You know, vocally, of course, it's like this dream role that we all kind of study the arias in college as mezzos and then look at it and kind of think maybe 35 to 40, maybe when I'm 35 to 40, not 28, but I'm doing it now. And, you know, there's great challenges with it, but like it's a way I can develop. I can develop a lot with the role.
And tell us a little bit about your Charlotte.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's what I find really interesting about her is the kind of journey she takes from the beginning to the end. She's, you know, at home with the family and has a lot of responsibility with the kids and that, and the chores, the everyday chores at home. And then when she comes across Verterra, it's like her whole being changes. You know, she suddenly can't really focus on the kids anymore. Her whole mind is taken up with him. And
now she has another beau, hasn't she? Has she at that stage?
Yes,
Albert.
Of course. And this
yes,
is the
that's
issue.
A bit of a complication.
Yeah,
yes,
this is the issue. So she, throughout the whole opera, we see her kind of going back and forth. Will she go with Verterra? Will she go with Albert? And yeah, it's really interesting to see how she changes, you know, how she deals with that frustration and deals with the, you know, the heartbreak she's going through.
And you're a mezzo soprano.
Yes.
And this is written for a mezzo soprano.
Yeah.
How important is that? Because sometimes you mightn't be singing always in the mezzo register.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of roles that are zwischenfach, like between soprano and mezzo. And as a kind of young singer, it's good to kind of try everything. And so I've done a lot of the higher mezzo stuff, which is a lot of the Mozart repertoire is quite high for mezzo. Whereas this role, Massenet, is really for a mezzo. And it goes right from the bottom of the range right up and does, it's very lyric, but also quite dramatic. So there's a lot of gear changes in the voice, which is kind of difficult to navigate, but also a great challenge. So yeah.
And the other characters in it, obviously there's Verterra and then there's Albert and there's other women in your sisters, I think.
Sophie,
is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a domestic piece in a sense, in that the first act we're in Charlotte and her sister Sophie's house, and their mother has died 2 years previous in our production, 2 years previous. And their father is trying to manage a number of children. I think in the novel, there's 9 younger children than Charlotte and Sophie. So the roles that Charlotte and Sophie have to perform are numerous. They're managing and minding 7 children as well as a father. And I think in late 19th century France, where Massenet was sort of setting the piece, it's a hell of a task. And as we carry on through the acts, Act 2 sees Charlotte married. So all of those tasks have been taken away from her. She has she's less to do. By Act 3, we see her in Albert's house and she's unable to do anything other than write letters, or she's freed to write letters to Verterra. Mm. And that sort of exacerbates the unrequited love of the opera, this kind of removing Charlotte away from the family.
It must be just seeping with passion, is it?
It really
is. So beautiful.
Yeah. I mean, the music, you can't get nicer. This like French romantic music, it's an absolute dream.
Tell us about some of the arias.
Yeah, so I don't actually have much to sing in the first 2 acts. And then in the 3rd act, I have 3 arias in a row. So it's a huge thing for Charlotte in Act 3. And then in Act 4, it's just myself and Verterra the death of Arthur. And I have the first aria I have is the letter aria, which is one I've done for years and ones I've done for auditions, like, for the last kind of 6 years. And finally, to kind of have it in the full context of the opera is really, it's mad. I kind of every day in rehearsals, I think, oh my God, this is, we're doing this as in the full opera, which is so much better than standing on a stage for an audition just singing.
So
the aria.
Leaves because he the love is unrequited, yeah. Or he fears, yeah, it's unrequited, and so he writes letters.
He writes
to
me
you.
Letters, and I
how
sing.
Romantic.
Yeah, and I sing the letters. I mean, and I you know, it's a long aria, reading the letters and kind of going in between, and all the more joyful letters, the more sorrowful letters, and then I go and sing another short aria. Just to my sister Sophie, saying, please just let me cry, give me a moment, let me go through this. And then I do a third aria, praying to God, which is more dramatic then. So that's the three that I have in Act Three.
Now we have Il faut nous séparer. Mm-hmm. So tell us what the context of that one, Niamh.
Yeah, so that's after my first meeting with Werther. So we have a night together and we come back and I say, now it's time for you to leave. And then he doesn't leave. And I tell him all about my mother and, about that situation.
So. Okay, so shall we hear Niamh O'Sullivan singing Il faut nous séparer? Niamh O'Sullivan there singing Il faut nous séparer from Werther, which is the Irish National Opera's touring show. And I'm also with Sophie Motley, the director. The pianist there was Richard Pearson, and he's very involved musically in the production.
He is, yeah. So Richard has also arranged the orchestral score, because we're touring to medium-sized venues around the country. A giant symphony orchestra doesn't quite fit in the Solstice in Navan or in the Everyman in Cork. So Richard has arranged the music for an ensemble or an orchestra of 12 musicians, based on certain kind of new arrangements of the music by Philip Pointner, the conductor. So it will feel a little different for audiences to sitting in the concert hall and listening to a concert performance of the piece. But I think it will feel a lot more resonant. It will feel a lot
intimate,
more intimate.
Sure.
Because singers are so much closer to you.
Yeah. Now that was that is a duet, Il faut nous séparer, and obviously Werther is the other side of that duet. Tell us a little bit about Parid Cataldo, who is the tenor.
Paride Cataldo, it's his first time in Ireland. He is an astonishing Italian tenor.
Yep.
I mean, listening to him and Niamh sing in rehearsal bowls you over, and I'm so excited to see what audiences are going to get to experience, because he's incredibly talented. This piece, in the front of the score, of Massenet's score, it says that that Charlotte is 21 and Werther is 23. All of the productions that I watched and listened to whilst researching this, the singers were in their 40s, because usually the voice has to develop that much for a singer to be able to sing these roles. They're
it's huge. It's now, like, I think Paddy there is probably one of the youngest Werthers to ever sing the role, because you can count like on two hands the amount of Werthers there actually are in the world that, you know, really do it. I mean, it's massive. Mm-hmm. It's a huge challenge. And for us to do so many performances in such a short space of time is another challenge in itself.
OK, yeah. So shall we listen to him responding to you as Charlotte here from Il faut nous séparer? There there is Paris Cataldo singing Il faut nous séparer from Werther, and Richard Pearson was again on piano. It is about the emotional depth that Massenet brings to the music, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think the brilliant thing about opera is you have this ability to know. The music tells you how to feel. And what Niamh and Paride are doing on top of that is the nuance of character, but also just layers upon layers of romantic beauty.
Yeah, it's amazing what Massenet does. It's like he writes everything that he wants into the score, so you don't have much to kind of think about. He shows you exactly what he wants, which is really, really interesting actually, and really satisfying to be able to follow those instructions that he has written down for us in the score.
Now, as we said, it was written in 1892. So where is this version set? Where is your version set, Sophie?
Well, the original novel was set in the 1770s. Massenet set it in 1892. And we're setting it in very early 1950s rural Ireland. So myself and Sarah Bacon and Sarah Jane Shields, who are the brilliant designers working on the production, have sort of sat down and really dug into the piece, and it's set in a rural space. It's set outside a house in the countryside in the first act. It's set in a communal meeting space in a village in the second act, and the third and fourth act are in and around houses. And it made absolute sense to myself and Sarah to set it in a rural space.
And could it be France or could it be Ireland, given that it's written in French?
It could. I mean, we're using the magic of theatre in that we're setting it in Ireland, but everybody's singing in French and they have German names. But for us, it's set at the height of the rural electrification scheme across rural Ireland, which was at its real height at that point. And it just made sense in terms of every single character. Albert is a salesman. In our production, he's the ESB salesman who travels from town to town selling electricity. And there's two comic characters in the first two acts called Johann and Schmidt. And for our production, they're the wiremen. So they, again, they're slight outsiders, and they came in to bring the electricity to the town. So our Act Two celebration is the blessing of the electric kettle and the electric oven.
It's great. Yeah. I love it.
It works really well. It's also, I think, in terms of the journey of the piece, Charlotte becomes more isolated and desolate through lack of domesticity and lack of things to do. So in the first act, we see pre-electric activity such as washing being run through an Acme.
That was most of her
mangle.
Work. I mean, you know, like she has, now that this is taken away from her in our production, you see her just kind of, you know, with kind of nothing to do. I mean, and only think of her hair, and it makes it kind of her even more desperate, you know, because she is.
As an opera singer, Niamh, you've obviously got two things going on when you're in an opera. You have the acting, you have Sophie's vision, you're interacting with your co-stars.
Yeah.
And then you have the music. Are they two things that are pulling in different directions, or is it easy to merge both?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important to have the music really, really secure in your body and bones, and that you've really done the preparation so that you can come into the rehearsal room and kind of just layer the concept on top and what the director wants. But it's just like super satisfying to be able to do the two together, and to be able to create characters with our voice as well, which is really interesting.
Yeah, I guess at the same time, we have to be really aware that during the difficult bits, singers need to be doing a hell of a lot of things, in that poor Niamh is trying to count in her head, trying to watch a man flinging his arms in the air, and
trying
also
to
trying to
French.
Think about a character, think about speaking in French, and think about being in love.
Exactly. It's a lot. Multitasking.
No more bother to you.
Yeah.
Well, Werther is on nationwide tour from Saturday the 22nd of April to Sunday the 14th of May to Letterkenny, Navan, Galway, Limerick, Dundalk, Ennis, Cork, Waterford, Kilkenny and Dunleary. Further details on irishnationalopera.ie. And my thanks to Niamh O'Sullivan and Sophie Motley. Best of luck with that. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Paula Shields.
Harry Buckless was on sound. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator, and tonight's show was produced by Regina Luby. And John Creedon is next.